Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Environment Natural Resources Committee for Monday, May 20th. This is our second to last week. Gentlemen, I know everyone's... Okay. So we have a number of work sessions today, and we also have several public hearings. Rep. Bailey, so what we're going to do, just so folks know, we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2801A, then we'll recess that, because we have one member that's going to be running a little late, and I know he wants to be here for the work sessions. Then we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on HJM 2. We have another representative here, and we may, if we have all five of our members, we may do the work session so some of the people who are waiting for that can leave. So with that, we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2801A. Beth, can you provide us with a reminder of the bill?
Madam Chair, House Bill 2801A, there's a no revenue impact on the dash A13 amendments, and we're still waiting for the fiscal on the A13 amendments, but my understanding it may be able to come today. So that bill allows the public purpose monies invested in cost-effective local energy conservation for updating non-residential buildings to be used for whole building energy efficiency assessments. And then there's a dash A13 amendment that's going to be similar to the dash A7 that you heard during the last meeting. The main differences here is that the dash A13 requires rules adopted on certification of home assessors may not allow for reporting of individual addresses or residential structures names, but may allow for reporting of information that would allow ODOE to make aggregated evaluations of the savings attributable to energy efficiency.
Okay, and we have Representative Bailey to speak to the amendment, and I believe you've been working with Senator Olson on this. Is that correct?
He's not going to bet that.
In front of all these people, yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jules Bailey, representing House District 42. Thank you for this opportunity. I want to start with a series of thank yous, actually, on the dash 813s. Big thank you to Vice Chair Olson for his digging in on this, and I think coming up with a better product that actually addresses some concerns that were raised on the House side. And Senator, at the risk of straying into it, in the amendment in the A13s, after line 13, it's line 3 of the amendment, it says after line 13, insert, and there's a paragraph there that really gets at privacy concerns, make sure that we're only collecting aggregated data, that there isn't personally identifiable information, that really protects the integrity of the data that's coming in while ensuring that it's still being used to monitor what is the overall efficiency for the state of Oregon. I think this is an excellent amendment, makes a better bill. I also really want to thank Bob Keith and Lori Egan and Brian Glanville for making Section 14 and Section 15 a better product. There is one more change from the dash 7s that are incorporated into Section 15. We're trying to give the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board a little bit of extra time to be able to go through this work and get the right answers back to the legislature. And so we've asked them to check in with us in February 2014 to the short session, but we've stated here that these are initial findings. These aren't the final findings, and we've asked that they can continue on with that work so that they're not quite so time-constrained in how they get back to us. So it's more of a check-in. And as we mentioned before in the previous testimony, Section 14 focuses on considering energy efficiency improvements in the structure. Again, there's no requirement in here, and I want to state that clearly for the record, that there's no requirement in this bill that they have to make any specific kind of assessment or have any kind of specific certification as they make that assessment. It's just codifying what's essentially an existing practice into a statute is that they consider it. And from my understanding from the appraisers is that's what all good appraisers are really doing as it is making that kind of consideration based on their judgment and their training. So with Sections 14 and 15, and again, want to thank Bob Keith and Lori Egan and Brian Glanville for their digging in and helping on this and the additional changes to the ODO section and how they keep information. I believe this bill is ready to go and appreciate your consideration.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for the representative before we let him go? We do not have the fiscal yet, And we're hoping, if we get it back before we adjourn today, we'll be able to reopen the work session, because I will recess it. So thank you for your hard work on that. Any other questions before we let them go back to the House? Thanks, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate you working. And, of course, we need to thank our excellent committee staff for making sure that there was coordination between the House and Senate.
Madam Chair and Beth, owe you a big one.
All right, thanks. With that, we'll go ahead and recess the work session on House Bill 2801A. We'll go ahead then and open up the public hearing on HJM2. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Joint Memorial 2 is a no revenue, no fiscal impact, and it urges the United States Secretary of Interior to allow enhancement of management of cormorants by the state of Oregon.
Okay, so with that, we have Representative Krieger, who would like to come up and give us some testimony. Welcome back. Oops. Representative Bailey just forgot something. We thought you wanted to testify in cormorants, too. Representative Krieger is getting nervous.
I think he voted for it.
Yeah.
Chair Dingford, committee members, for the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1, South Coast. HJM 2 comes to you from the Ag Committee and Natural Resources on the House side by good vote, and it urges the U.S. Secretary of Interior to allow enhanced management of cormorants by the state of Oregon. The 1973 Bird Treaty provided complete protection of cormorants. Since that time, their population has greatly expanded. In this case, we have protection of a predator that is killing our endangered salmon and steelhead. The largest population of cormorants is at the mouth of Columbia River, and it's estimated to be at greater than 13,000 pairs. And keep in mind that they're only counting adults. The 1, 2, and 3-year-olds are not counted, nor are those in the upper pools of the Columbia River on up Snake River area and up above. So the number is a lot greater than that. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife studies on Halen Bay show that cormorants kill 50% of the salmon and steelhead smolts. And if depending on how you read that study and some of the others that are coming out in the ALC, those numbers probably are greater than 50%. We invest $57 million per biennium, federal and state dollars, in our hatcheries. To allow a predator that is not endangered to kill 50% of investment is not realistic. To put this into perspective, that's $28 million a biennium, over $1 million a month, and over $250,000 a week of our hatchery production is allowed to be eaten by a predator that is not endangered. What is even worse is we have an equal number, and in some places a greater number, of our wild fish also being consumed at that same rate. So when we're trying to increase production, protect these fish, we're sitting right here at the same time, allowing predators to eat them at a great, great rate. The largest driver in the coastal community's economy is the availability of salmon during our seasons for both sport and commercial. Oregon would join 24 to 26 states, depends where you read, now being allowed to manage cormorants. The bill is very important to Oregon coastal communities. We ask for your support.
I think a senator has joined you.
I did.
Do you want to go ahead and then we'll see if there's any questions?
Yeah, I mean, for the record, Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5. One of the reasons, and part of it, my family raised me in Port Angeles, which is right on the coast, and my dad was an Aberdeen, and so I've had an opportunity to spend almost my entire life on the coast, either Washington or Oregon, and I love it. I mean, it's a beautiful place. It's a wonderful place. When we started listing species on the coast and making winners and losers, I believe we made a real mistake. And, you know, Oregon is now trying to look at things when we look at the reserves, to manage them by the ecosystem and talking about all the interdependencies. And when you take species out of the interdependency link and don't manage them, you end up with anomalies. And so you'll see forests, if you drive the coast from Coos Bay to Reedsport, and as you're leaving Reedsport going north, you'll look to the left, and there's a little island over there, and all of the trees are dead. It's a standing dead forest. And they are dead because they don't do well when too many cormorants go to the bathroom on them. And so they have been turned white, and they have died. There's a couple other little islands just off Coos Bay where there were only a couple trees that were standing out there majestically on this big rock. It is dead now because of the overabundance of birds and their guana that they leave behind. And so it points out that nature, in my opinion, abhors winners and losers that are picked by us. We have managed these critters in ways that creates a problem for other interdependent species. And the big one is, here we are trying to recover salmon on the coast. We're looking at lots of ways of doing that. And then what we find is that creates a bigger population of these birds who then wait and eat at the bays and harbors. And I think, as Representative Krieger pointed out, the latest data show almost 50% of our hatchery fish don't make it to the ocean to try start their other difficult journey, steelhead all the way to Russia and others all the way up to the Alaska and back. And I believe we should have the right. I watch these step people in Florence get out in their boats because they got the permission to harass. And so they're out there with fireworks and all sorts of things, trying to keep the cormorants off the feeding frenzy that's going on when the fish start coming down the system. And we need to do more than that. You know, we have marine protection. We have these avian protections that I think are doing a disservice to the whole area and managing all of the resources so that we have a general population. What DDT did to the cormorants and what we have done in the past was not the answer, but they have recovered now, and I think we need to start looking at other ways in which we help manage that population in relationship to all of the other things that are going on. And I think this bill is a beginning to have the get some of the answers that we need to solve it. You know, the fact that other states don't have the populations we have, in my opinion, are already being given the opportunity to manage that by take indicates to me that we should be in the same position. And I know our Fish and Wildlife has tried to get that. We haven't been successful. I think this is a good way of letting Congress know that we would like to have an active participation in the management of this bird. And it is beautiful. I mean, anybody who's gone on the coast and watched them fish or just watched them fly, they're an amazing animal or bird. But it's time that we manage it. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Gentlemen, I am going to be calling up the department after you do provide us with what the status is for their request. But any questions for either of these gentlemen before we let them go? Senator Olson.
Senator Robel, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. Even away from birds, even when we get in as a state pick winners and losers in industry, I think you probably knew that was coming. But it surprises me that we put this volume into the hatcheries, and then we do some of the silliest things, like we create a sand island where these birds can live and just feed just voraciously on all these salmon. I think that this will be a good start. We need to really push this. We have problems with our fish, and we need to, you know, we have problems with sea lions coming up and doing the same thing. Of course, they're protected. But this is a good start, and I wholeheartedly will support all of this action to help the fisheries.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, gentlemen. And we have several people want to testify, but we are going to ask the department to come up first. I think Kurt Melcher's here, and I asked him to provide us with sort of a brief overview of what the status is and with the cormorant situation. Maybe just give us a little history, and then ODF&W's involvement in jurisdiction versus U.S. Fish and Wildlife, I think, would be helpful.
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I apologize, I have a wolf bill up in a hearing downstairs, so I've been kind of playing back and forth here. But so I heard the emphasis on the word brief, and so I will attempt to be brief. Cormorants are managed, and they're managed under the auspices of the federal migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is a multinational treaty that was signed by the United States and other countries as it relates to migratory birds and their management. Cormorants, double-crested cormorants in this particular case, come under that jurisdiction. As such, any action that the state wants to take, we have to go through a federal approval process with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I didn't hear all the earlier testimony, but we have embarked on that process. We have applied for the take authority as a state, I want to say about a year ago, and that application was turned down, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service gave us some information on additional data needs that they would require before giving the state the independent authority to take a management action that would include lethal actions. We certainly have authority right now for hazing, I think, as you heard mentioned. And we do have a limited permit where we're actually taking some cormorants as part of a diet study in several estuaries. And that diet study is part of one of the requests of the Fish and Wildlife Service before they give us the take authority. I think if you look back, and I my career has not been that long, but over the three decades of my career back when I began in the early 1980s, cormorants, double-crested cormorants, were relatively uncommon on the Columbia. There certainly were cormorants present, but not in great numbers. And certainly today, without a doubt, cormorant numbers have grown exponentially over that 25 or 30-year period. And the department recognizes that. And in fact, the biological opinion on the Columbia for the many, many listed species in the Columbia recognizes avian predation as a critical factor. And so we're keenly interested in additional management authority. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any more questions. I tried to be brief.
Okay. Senator Hansel.
Let me ask three quick questions. Are they native birds to Oregon?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, absolutely, they're native species.
What are their migratory patterns? Where do they go to when they migrate?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder and Senator Hansel, they certainly migrate up and down the coast in the Pacific coast, perhaps as far north as southeast Alaska. I don't know the specific seasonal migration patterns. There are individuals who do know that and certainly could bring some additional information to you either offline or...
Follow up.
Third question, what is their natural enemy?
Bald eagles?
Yeah, certainly. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, and we have seen, I think it was mentioned that this habitat alterations in the lower Columbia has been a big factor in the explosion and expansion of the population. Certainly, bald eagles are a predator. I think much of the predation on populations would occur at the egg to young, pre-fledgling time frame, and those would be other birds, not necessarily raptors, but including seagulls and other ravens, hawks, other avian predators. We saw, I believe it was last year, a near total failure of the reproductive colony in the lower Columbia as a result of bald eagle predation. As you know, we've had an expanding and recovering bald eagle population in not only in Oregon, but on the West Coast. They, in fact, were just recently delisted, both on the state and the federal endangered species list. And bald eagles, as their numbers increase, they've honed in on this colony in the lower Columbia and led to quite a bit of impact.
Thank you. Questions? And what is the current status of the species? Is it listed, threatened?
Chair Dingfelder, no, they're not.
Concern?
They're not listed under the Endangered Species Act for any protection. They're simply listed under the migratory or protected under the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
Okay. All right. Well, Senator Olson isn't here, and we'll have to follow up with you one-on-one. Thank you. We're going to hear from some other folks, but appreciate the. Response. And actually, one other, Kurt, as far as you were saying, you're waiting to have those studies, what's the time frame before you get back to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with that additional information?
Chair Dingfelder, off the top of my head, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's a multi-year study, though, where we've been collecting stomachs from double-crested cormorants and doing some analysis. I don't know. Okay. I can follow up with you on that.
Great. That would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, we have a number of people signed up. I'm just going to read down the list. Bob Salinger, is Bob here somewhere? Yep, Bob. We have Bill Cluding and Stan Steele. So I'm just going to call you up. Doesn't mean you're on the same side of an issue, but we're going to just get people up here. Okay. So, Bob, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. I am here today on behalf of our 13,000 members to urge you to reject the joint memorial number two, calling for enhanced management of double-crested cormorants to protect salmon from natural predation. I think it's important that folks understand what enhanced management means. It's a euphemism. What we're really talking about here is killing thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of birds. It's wholesale slaughter of birds. And these are birds, as you've heard, that are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. What the state has proposed in the past is killing up to 10% of the Oregon population. We are very concerned about salmon. We are not indifferent to salmon. We're not just a bird organization. In fact, we've brought a couple of lawsuits in the last couple of years to protect salmon. So it's not a birds versus salmon issue for us. There are a variety of reasons why we think this memorial is not appropriate. First of all, we are casting a wider and wider net of manipulation and killing to protect salmon. And we question whether that is a reasonable and rational way to proceed. It's not just about double-crested cormorants. It's about Caspian terns, gulls, sea lions, and a variety of other species that may be managed as well in the near future. A lot of these management activities have had unintended consequences. If you look at the management activities to date at the mouth of the Columbia on East Sand Island and Rice Sand Island, much of that is not going as was expected. In some cases, it's having counterproductive impacts. So we're not as smart as we think we are when it comes to manipulating large populations of birds. We appreciate the fact that there may be some cases where very specific, very targeted, limited control of one species to protect another imperiled species may make sense. We have supported that in some instances, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about massive manipulation of huge bird populations on an ongoing, perhaps permanent basis, and huge numbers of dead birds at the end of the day. These are creatures that have coexisted with each other for millennia. We believe where we really need to focus is on the primary causes of salmon decline. That is the dams, that is habitat loss and fragmentation, and that is degrading sea ocean conditions. We think this resolution is particularly untimely because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is doing an EIS right now on double-crested cormorants. They're looking at this issue closely. They have rejected the state's request to have the enhanced management now, and the reason they did that was because the state lacks data in order to support it. This is a very shrill approach to a problem without data backing it. And without that, the right answer is not to approve it. What the feds have done is they have issued scientific taking permits to allow the state to research this, look at the actual issue in the locations where they think there is a problem, and assess it so they can make a thoughtful, knowledgeable, science-based decision rather than one based on politics. Under those circumstances, U.S. Fish and Wildlife has given the right answer. Go back, do your homework, and then come back with a proposal that actually can demonstrate that these birds are really having the impact you say they are, and that your management activities are likely to be successful in dealing with the problems you see. We're particularly concerned about the way cormorants have been elevated into the political arena because there is really a potential here to take a population that is doing well and put it into very serious decline. And the reason we're so worried is that you have already hazing going on at the mouth of the Columbia. That's a population that is the difference between an increasing and a decreasing population, that population alone at the mouth of the Columbia. You have hazing, both legal and illegal, going on up and down the Oregon and Washington coasts. You have no identified places anywhere at this time where cormorants would be accepted and allowed to breed free of harassment. There is no place that the state or the feds have identified where they don't consider cormorants a problem. Under those circumstances, you have a recipe, if you add the state with pretty much unlimited killing power, to create a real problem. And so we encourage the feds to continue on the process they're on, look carefully at this problem, do the science, and figure out what the best strategy is. We think for the state to weigh in now and put political pressure on the feds to make a quicker decision without the science and to presume the answer just politicizes the process, undermines the credibility of the process, and undermines the efficacy of future management actions. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill? Or whoever wants to go next. Stan, and I know you're not going to read your three pages of testimony, but we do have the written testimony. Thank you. Or actually, it's five pages. Very prolific these days.
Very factual. Do you want me to go, Bill?
Yeah, of course.
Senator Dingfelder, Chair, the rest of the committees, my name is Stan Steele. We're here in support of the House Joint Memorial 2. This is an issue about responsible wildlife management. It's science-based management throughout the state, not just of cormorants, but of salmonids and all of our species. Single species management specifically is what's caused so many of our habitats to become pretty much wildlife free. And what goes on with salmonids is they say the science isn't there. Well, we're failing to recognize what's went on in the lower Columbia for over 17 years on science-based research that has indicated we're losing up to 22 million smolts a year to double-crested cormorants, in addition to another 5 million to Caspian terns. Then let's move on to the coast. We have 13 estuaries, I believe, and I could be off because I can't count them all, don't keep them all straight. But the point is, in each one of these estuaries, we have uncounted populations. Earlier we heard that the feds were the ones doing the science. Well, that's not true. The feds administer the Migratory Bird Protection Act. They do not do the science. The science is left up to the state. The state is required to come up with an inventory of what's going on currently in Oregon. The federal government had not even reviewed the last 5 years of aerial photography of the bird, specifically cormorant populations, on the coast. They're not keeping up with the science. What we need to understand is that this is not just an issue about killing birds. It's about managing wildlife. And when we live in such a highly altered atmosphere and landscape is what we currently do, if we're not going to be the person who manages it, or the state, or the agency, then who is? There's less than 1% of the savanna habitat left for western meadowlarks in the Willamette Valley. Would it be reasonable to expect to see a western meadowlark population equal to what there was in 1850? No, it's been highly altered, as well as their coastal estuaries. These birds require good management, science-based management, and understand that they're part of an ecosystem. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stan. Bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Co-chairs, for the record, Bill Junior Cluding. It's too bad we didn't have this discussion a decade ago. It's almost beyond repair. I've kept this as a one-pager for the last five sessions. All I do is keep doubling the numbers. As you can see, this year alone, we're going to lose 30 million smolts at Sand Island. Madam Chair, Committee, let me tell you about Sand Island. It was not there at one time. The Army Corps of Engineers and their dredging deposits have made a bed and breakfast for the cormorants that drew them out of the state of Washington, drew them to that island, and right now there's 15,000 nesting pairs. Now, at one time I thought maybe one egg per hatch was the norm, but no, they lay up to seven eggs. That island is so compacted with birds, they've spread everywhere. They spread the Tillamook, they spread all the way down to the southern coast. In fact, I can show you a flock of hundreds right here in the Willamette waiting at the North Sandy Am, where we're spending millions of dollars on trying to get salmon up past those dams. The cormorants are waiting for them. They've already shut down the fishery for the summer Chinook, Umatilla. The run did not show up like it was proposed. The reason why Sand Island is so important, it's right where the salt water and fresh water meet. And these smolts take 3 to 4 weeks to adjust to salt water. If they shoot on through, it destroys their liver, they die. So 3 to 4 weeks, Madam Chair, Committee, they circle right there. One cormorant can eat 25 smolts a day. The head of the Bonneville Power Administration is retiring. And in his departing speech, he said, we spent $13 billion in the Northwest on salmon. And he says, we're going to spend billions more. I might add that 24 other states have already, and by a lot less problems than what we're having with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, 24 other states in the Midwest and back East right now are controlling their cormorants 7 months out of the year. They're allowed to shoot them. Anybody can shoot any bird anywhere as long as it's the property owner gives permission. And we're not talking about they're trying to save threatened fish. We're talking walleye, perch, farm-raised trout, whatever. We asked the question the other day about why is Oregon held to such a higher, stricter standard when we're trying to save our salmon population? And I think I'll stop right there. You'll hear more expert testimony on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these gentlemen? Senator Bates.
Do any of you know what the population, thank you, Madam Chair. Do any of you know what the population of cormorants has done since 1972 in the state? Does anybody have a data on that, actually know what the number is? Because when DDT went out, that's when it became protected. You know, my information is anecdotal. Crane Prairie, Gold Lake, Lakes Interior, 200 miles from the ocean. We got cormorants there. We didn't have them back in the 70s and 80s. They've gone way inland now, but I don't know if that's an effect of overpopulation or what's happening.
Senator, I'm sure we can get the department to follow up and get that information.
Okay. Senator, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Bates, if I may, from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's work on the Lower Columbia, 1989, we had 90 active nests. In 2010, we had 13,600 breeding pairs.
I saw that. I want to know statewide.
Okay, and statewide, it's an increasing population. However, the census is only taking on the coast and the Lower Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just looking it up on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, so I can get you that link. I can send that to you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
One quick thing on that, too. Yeah. They have concentrated at the coast at Sand Island. There's no question about that. They've also winked out in a lot of other places. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that population is the difference between an increasing and a decreasing population. So you have an incredible concentration at the coast, right, at the mouth of the Columbia River, no question about it. Also terns and other species as well that have concentrated there because of the Dred Spoil Islands. So just be clear on that. We don't think that's a healthy thing to have all those birds concentrated in one place. But whether you go and kill them is another question.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you for your testimony. We have a few other folks signed up. Dennis Ritchie, Doug Cavaugh. Am I saying that right? Okay, sorry. Yeah, that is a V, isn't it? Dana Roberts? Is it a Dana or Dan?
You're okay, I'm okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just want to make sure I was calling you by the right name there. All right. Mr. Ritchie, if you want to start off.
Thank you. Senator Dingfelder, chair, co-chair, and senators. My name is Dennis Ritchie. Post Office Box 253 in West Lynn. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Anglers Research Society. Basically, it's a volunteer group that works throughout the state. Now, one thing I'd really like to counter is the idea of thousands, hundreds of thousands of birds being slaughtered. That's the kind of rhetoric we got from the Humane Society when we tried to do something with the sea lions, and we went through many lawsuits. I represent all the sports fishermen in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on that federal task force. And to date, we have placed about 20 sea lions in zoos, and we have terminated about 30 is all over the 3 years, and the reason those 30 were terminated, not placed, was because they had terminal diseases that I'd rather not go into here. The birds are increasing everywhere. They're being found in places where they never were. You go up the Little North Fork of the Santa Am, half an hour from here. Never had there been cormorants until this year. And there are numbers of breeding pairs up there, and people are very concerned about how they're spreading out. And that doesn't mean that the numbers are decreasing down at the Columbia. We must do something, and believe me, the feds will make sure we do it in a fair and reasonable way.
Great, thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, distinguished committee members, my name is Doug Cave, and I'm the president of the Mackenzie River Guides Association. We have seen, I live in the southern Willamette Valley, up the Mackenzie River. We have seen an area that historically did not have this bird population. It is also an area that is home to two listed species, the bull trout, as well as the upper Willamette Spring Chinook, which is the last native spring Chinook run. I think in the state of Oregon, if not along the West Coast. And just over the last 5 years where we had zero population of double-crested cormorants, I've seen that population increase each year in areas that we had never seen them in the past. In particular, the last couple of years at Leeburg Lake, there was zero. And this is a diversion lake. It's a small impoundment of the Eugene Water and Electric Board utility I worked for 32 years. And it is also an area where the fish migrate through the dam, upstream and downstream, and the bull trout as well as the spring Chinook. And this population, even though these are considered migratory birds, these birds do not migrate. They stay there all year long. It has gone from two birds to six birds to eight birds. There's a couple of trees similar to those ones you've seen on the coast that are now dying because of the constant fertilization that's happening. But these birds have this unending food supply, at least they think, until those fish are gone. And that population of bull trout was estimated only approximately 100 fish within that reach of the lower 60 miles of the Mackenzie River. And you see a fish that eats a pound, or a bird that eats a pound of fish a day can have an extreme impact on this listed species. We have seen the number of returning salmon continue to be impacted, even though there's been incredible work and enhancement in habitat. Enhancement in fish passage in the lower river. We've seen the cormorants move into a setup where they put in a fish screen to divert all the juvenile fish so they would not go through the power plant at Walterville. And that has now become a cormorant feeding facility. And it's literally about a half mile from my home. And I apologize for not having current photographs of that, but I've seen the number of cormorants working that outgoing population. We have three active colonies on the Mackenzie now, a large one at 42nd and Main Street, 42nd and Mackenzie Highway. We have a couple of populations, one behind Valley River Center, that is now working an area where the ponds were created as additional habitat for downstream migrating fry and smolts to grow in somewhat protected area, and once again has become a feeding area. Utilities have invested millions and millions, and now I heard billions of dollars, and I know the Eugene Water Electric Board has invested this kind of money in protecting and creating better passage for these fish, which should result in the enhanced populations, and unfortunately we're seeing the populations to continue to decrease. Several years ago we had outstanding outgoing flows that the fish should have gotten out to the ocean in good condition. But the numbers this year returning up over Willamette Falls and the conditions for passage over the Willamette Falls is the best it's been in years as far as water temperature. And we're seeing a very dismal steelhead return and a minimal spring Chinook return as well. This is a trend that cannot be continued and sustain these fishes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Dana Roberts. I live in Salem, Oregon. And I'm a volunteer with the Coastal Conservation Association of Oregon. CCA Oregon would like to voice our support for House Joint Memorial 2, urging the United States Secretary of the Interior to allow enhanced management of cormorants by the state of Oregon. According to the Department of Fish and Wildlife documents, the double-crested cormorant community or colony at East Sand Island on the Columbia River is the largest colony in the western North America.
and that colony alone consumes about 11 million juvenile salmonoids a year, and that was in 2010. You've heard testimony today that it is up as much now as 20 million salmonoids a year. Double-crested cormorants have historically been present in Oregon, but received federal protection in 1972 by the Migratory Bird Protection Act. The Oregon population of double-crested cormorants has increased over 20% in the last 20 years. Population increases have been observed in all of our waters of the state, and so has their impact on juvenile salmonoids. 24 states currently have the lethal control authority given and monitored by the federal government to control double-crested cormorant populations. CCA Oregon recognizes that many predator populations have reached artificial and unnatural levels due to human actions and conflicting laws. CCA Oregon supports science-based efforts to decrease the impact of predation on adult and juvenile salmonoids. It is our belief that enhanced management by the state is most likely to result in the appropriate level of avoiding either over or under reductions of cormorants. They need to be managed appropriately at a certain population. We support passage of House Joint Memorial 2 and ask the U.S. Secretary of the Interior to allow the State of Oregon authority for enhanced management of double-crested cormorants. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these gentlemen? Okay, thank you very much. And we have Joe Relator, he's the last person. Anybody else like to testify on this bill that did not sign up? Joe, come on up. We're waiting for you.
Yeah.
No, that's all right. We'll just do it because he's here.
I saw Representative.
Yeah. No, he's next, Bill. So come on up.
Oh.
Unless Chair he wants Dean to represent events, you want to testify on cormorants as well?
Yeah. Members of the committee, my name's Joe Rollator. I represent Seafood Oregon and the McKenzie River Guides Association. There are probably many causes of salmon decline. Some of them are natural, like ocean conditions vary. Some of them, many of them, in fact, are man-made, like things like we over-harvested in the 90s because we didn't know how many fish were out there. We built roads and put in culverts that cut off spawning habitat. And some of that we can't ever get back. We filled overwintering habitat to build our cities and to make farmland so we could have milk. So cormorants are kind of in both classes. They're kind of native, they're kind of natural, they're kind of not. The Corps of Engineers built Sand Island. You heard all about that. That caused these birds to have a really great place to nest, and it was right where the smolts come down the Columbia estuary, and they have to stop for a few days, and their metabolism has to change from freshwater metabolism where they take water in through their mouths to where saltwater, where they take it through their skin. Whether the population has expanded or not over the years, it's probably variable. But the birds have concentrated on the Columbia. And that started about 20 years ago. The Corps of Engineers figured out about 15 years ago that there were a whole lot of cormorants eating a whole lot of their out-migrating salmon. And so they started figuring out ways to reduce that predation. So they're starting to disperse these birds. Well, about 10 years ago, we started seeing cormorants in places that we'd never seen them before, like Doug was talking about on the McKenzie. I grew up on the McKenzie. I'd never seen a cormorant. I didn't even know what they were. We got a pretty good idea of nesting pairs on the coast and in the Columbia. We probably have two or three non-breeding birds, double-crested cormorants for every breeding pair. On the LC where I live, the birds that are there all the time, and they're anywhere from none to 500, are those non-breeding birds. And so we don't know what's going to happen on those small coastal estuaries. I fish a lot of places that are really small rivers. They have really small populations. If the cormorants come in and move into some of those places for a couple of years, we could see those fish runs wink out completely, whether it's coho or chinook or steelhead. The information I handed out to you was information that we got from ODF&W at our last legislative work group on cormorants. I'm the volunteer staff for that group. We've been working for about 4 years to try to educate ourselves about double-crested cormorants and other kinds of predation, and that's the information that we got at our last meeting from the department. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I noticed you're wearing a cormorant on your lapel.
I had a heck of a time finding it this morning, but I did find it. And as you know, I wear pins of things that fish, and cormorants fish. Thank you.
I've actually seen the cormorants in China that fish, and they use them on boats
train
with
the fish.
With a collar
fishermen.
Around their neck
yeah.
to choke out the fish.
Right.
Which glad to say really, we don't do that here.
Seems really strange to me to do that.
Any questions for Joe before we close
well,
this?
Well, I just
one?
Like to, I fish, and I just wondered why you don't have a picture of me on your.
Not sure you want to go there, Senator.
You kill him? You eat him?
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, we will go ahead and close the public hearing, seeing that no one else wants to testify in this bill. We'll close the public hearing on HJM2. We'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2841A. And Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2841A requires agencies who adopt rules or issue orders relating to recreational or small-scale mining to appoint an advisory committee and requires that at least 30 days before agency gives notice of intended action to adopt, amend, or repeal rules pertaining to recreational or small-scale mining that the agencies perform consultation with specified persons and consider all reasonably available and relevant scientific studies. It stipulates that requirements do not apply to rules or orders issued prior to the effective date of the Act.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have Representative Bentz and Senator Furiel. You want to come up together? Show a bicameral effort here. Thank you, gentlemen, for your patience. We had to clear the deck of the cormorants before we brought you up here.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for hearing this bill. Cliff Bentz, District 60. And I'm sure this bill is designed primarily to get the miners out of the courtroom and back into some sort of mining activity. That's the concept, the very, very simple concept of the bill. There is already a consultation requirement in ORS 517.125. And this consultation requirement doesn't explain how consultation is to occur. So the purpose of this bill is to give some direction in how that consultation should happen, so there's no argument later about consultation not having occurred. And it's a simple concept. The rulemaking, this bill applies to both rulemaking and to orders. Rulemaking already has a consult requirement, but consult not defined, so this bill does that. Orders, when issued for these types of permits, don't require consult. This would add that consultation requirement to orders. So when orders are used to allow this type of action, small-scale mining, then this would also require a consult. So the idea is that the folks would come in and talk first and try to reach consensus and to avoid the need later for litigation. It's a very simple bill. We have worked extremely closely with DEQ, and I want to compliment them on their efforts. They have worked with us beyond all measure of a cooperation, and I really, really appreciate it. So I'm hopeful we reach the point where they are supportive. I guess they can speak for themselves. But I believe this bill would help remove folks from the courtroom and get them into the talking mode, which is where I would much rather have them than becoming jailhouse lawyers, which are 2 years of jailhouse lawyers already. I count myself as one. So with that, Madam Chair, I urge your ultimate support for this in the form of a work session. I understand today is just a public hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Most of us don't know very much about recreational or small-scale mining other than what's been communicated by interest groups, which is a lot. And depending on what is your source of information, you could form any number of opinions about small-scale mining, recreational mining, everything from panning to suction dredging. But at the end of the day, these folks who do this, they bristle when you say that it's recreational, because for some, it isn't recreational. It's what they do for a living. For others, it is purely a passion that they have, and so probably no two or three of these folks are exactly alike. They all pursue this for different reasons, but they consider themselves among the most regulated persons in Oregon. If they have a permit to do suction dredging or small-scale mining, there's quite a bit to know, quite a bit to do, and they are subject to quite a bit of scrutiny. And because this is part of the heritage of particularly rural Oregon mining areas, and because we care about the outcomes, which are the enjoyment of that heritage, but also environmental protection, jobs, et cetera, it's really important that we do have a strong regulatory network. But one of the most important things about sort of breaking down the assumptions people make about each other and the practices, we really actually need to have people at the table together discussing what it is that are the objectives of regulation and how best to achieve those regulations. If you look at the language that's suggested for amendment into 2841A-1, and we don't have a specific set of amendments, more of a concept that you've been provided, we really need people on all sides of this question to consider all reasonably available and relevant scientific studies. In other words, good science. Good consultation processes and an involvement of people that are both from the regulatory side of this equation and the regulated. So it would be really an optimal situation to have the folks from DSL for the fill and removal aspects and DEQ for the water quality aspects and representatives of the mining interest groups to consult directly to promote and exchange information, to facilitate meetings to discuss the efficacy of rules and what changes could be beneficial, to respond directly to questions that regulators may have, and to be able to develop a workable, clear, understandable, and efficient way to continue an activity that's been part of Oregon's history since the beginning in such a way that allows that to be sustained, but also does so in such a manner that the environmental issues are not compromised. The only way you get that is through a lot of collaboration. And I'll point out to you that that is exactly the model that was used for the Oregon Salmon Plan, the Oregon Plan for the Restoration of Salmon and Steelhead. It is exactly the model that we use for regulating agricultural practices and other practices where there's an interface between an emerging industry or a historic industry and an environmental concern. We used it for developing our policy on wind power in Oregon. We do it in a variety of ways, and the best methodology is always a collaboration. So I would urge you to think about how that collaboration would directly involve the interest group with the regulators. Failure to do that just leaves a gulf between the regulators and the regulations and the folks that promulgate and enforce these regulations. That always creates miscommunication. It will forever be a point of friction until people actually sit down, test their assumptions, start looking at science, and come to agreement. So that, Madam Chair, in a nutshell, is what we're after.
Thank you. Questions for any of these legislators? Yeah, Senator Hansel, sorry. I have a question for staff.
Well, not for staff, for for the 2841A-1, which I have before us. Are you wanting that in a dash amendment to the bill itself?
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel almost said Father O'Hansel. What's asked for is that the committee work its magic with the language that you have before it, ask for a legislative council to take this information and turn it into a format that the committee can use for an amendment. So, yes, that is what we desire.
Do we have that in front of us?
Madam Chair and committee members, just for the record, the document that Senator Hansel is referring to was submitted by Senator Farioli. It's in your packets on OLS and in the back of the room.
So, Madam Chair, that is more a concept than it is a usable amendment. Okay. And we would urge that you avail yourself of the magic of legislative council to convert it into a dash amendment.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I may add, there on Friday, the DEQ and the supporters of the bill were working on language, which I think they did reach agreement upon, and I believe we would have another dash draft for your review, I hope, today. Although I haven't spoken to anybody in the last few hours, maybe you already have it. But if you don't, you'll be getting one.
This is news to me, so I have not seen it up until about a minute ago.
Madam Chairman, operators are standing by for your call.
Yes, so I did have a question, and that's what I was trying to look up right now. It says agencies is defined, this is on line 7 through 8, is defined in ORS 183.310, which I'm looking up right now. So it's not just DEQ and DSL. That's what I was trying to get clarity on. And I could go grab the statutes. I want to just get on the record what agencies those were.
Madam Chair, I think we intended not to be exclusive. It's any agency that has a concern or a nexus to the regulation of small-scale or recreational mining. So it would be water quality, fill and removal, and others. And so we didn't want to be exclusive by defining. We basically just said agencies. Could be fish and wildlife.
Okay. And then I noticed on the second page that it said that the amendments do not apply to, and then it specifically calls out Department of Agriculture. And I was sort of perplexed about that because I wasn't.
Madam
I didn't
Chair,
think
we
ODA
have not
had
yet discovered how to grow gold. But if we do that, then the Department of Agriculture would be involved. Madam Chair, I think what that has to do with is the regulation of stream sides that also may be involved in agriculture.
Madam Chair, I've just been advised that the draft that you have before you is the draft indeed that it will be in formal form in the next hour or so, but you're looking at what it is now in its informal form. So.
Okay, well, I was actually looking at the engrossed, and that language is in the engrossed, so that's what I was curious about, but I'll take a look at the amendment. I just haven't had a chance to read through it yet, but thank you. Any other questions? Yep. Senator Olson and Senator Bates. Why don't you go ahead, Senator Olson?
All right. Thank you. Senator Farioli, you are probably aware that when we dealt earlier with placer mining bills, the Secretary of State was rather tepid to the work done by DSL and DEQ and ODFW, meaning that she felt that their oversight was not as it should be. Do you feel that this bill will provide the opportunity to open that door so that we have a more robust understanding and so that the agencies can work together to provide for appropriate oversight rather than the tepid oversight that we were led to believe?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't know what is in the Secretary of State's understanding of how rigorous those regulations are. I can tell you miners feel that they're extremely rigorous. But if you look at this, the language of this bill and the proposal that we bring before you, it is to get folks together to start discussing what outcomes they would like to see in regulation. And outcomes are the focal point, and from those outcomes you have a discussion about the best science and the best technology to get them.
And to do that, you need the cooperation of both the regulator and the regulated. So I would say that the concerns raised by not only the Secretary of State but others about whether or not these regulations are appropriate and efficacious, the place to have that discussion is when the regulators and the regulated are at the same table. I think whatever deficiencies there are will be explored. I think the best part of that is that technology, new technology and techniques need to be discussed and evaluated. So this calls specifically for the best science.
Senator Bates, did you have a question?
Just real quick, I'm just jumping back and forth between these two things. I think I understand this, and just correct me if I'm wrong. One, right now when rulemaking goes on, usually interested parties are notified, not always, but you're supposed to be. This calls out more specifically that frankly, miners and miners organizations need to be notified 30 days in advance. And one of them says something about a committee being set up to as an advisory committee, but I'm not seeing that in the staff changes. Does your amendment maintain the committee?
Madam Chair, and to your question, Senator Bates, I think this does formalize a working relationship between the miners' associations and the regulators. So it's one of those things where if some permittees are notified, and not all, or if some permittees are notified, but the most important information isn't conveyed back to the regulators, they can say, look, we sent out the notices, we threw a party, nobody showed up. That doesn't necessarily result in the best relationship between parties, and it doesn't get you the best information about what the current practices are or best practices are. But by formalizing that relationship, really the agency has a method to protect itself from criticism that they weren't rigorous enough in outreach because there's a formalized process for it. So I would say it would serve both the regulators and the regulated better by having a formal structure.
Does it call for an advisory committee?
I don't believe, Mr. Chairman, my colleague seems to think it does not. I don't think it does. However, it does talk about consultation. And if you look at the Endangered Species Act and any number of federal statutes, consultation means meeting between interest parties on a basis that allows them to exchange information for a product. Either an EIS, an environmental impact statement, or some other action that's contemplated. So that's the model I think you'd see here, consultation.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time and indulgence of the committee.
And we'll take a look at this amendment when I get out of the committee and have a chance to read it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we have Tom Kitchar, am I saying that right, who came from 100 miles, more than 100 miles, so we want to have him come up.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Tom Kitchar. I am a gold miner in Oregon since about 1986. I'm also president of the Waldo Mining District, which was formed in 1852. We're down in southern Oregon, where there happens to be probably the most recreational and small-scale mining occurring in all of Oregon. I'm also a co-author of this bill. I'm a little nervous and I'm a little buzzed from the long drive up here, so forgive me if I'm wandering just a little bit.
I do have a question for you, Tom, though.
Sure.
Did you also draft this amendment since we just received it?
Yes, helped, yes.
Okay, or helped draft it. Okay, thank you.
Since, amazingly, our original intent of this bill was to add two words to ORS 517-125, and those two words were "and order." So it would just be any rule or order pertaining to, and this is what it's grown into. Originally, it was about 12 pages.
And welcome to our world of working with the
yes,
attorneys.
I'm getting quite the education in the process. I really want to thank the Department of Environmental Quality folks. We have had extensive work with them in clarifying the language that all of us could live with. We believe, the mining community believe, this is a fair amendment. It's not pro-mining. It's not anti-mining. It's about cooperation. And what was behind this is in 1999, the legislature understood that mining today, especially on the small level that we're at, is such, I don't know how to describe this, it's like all other laws are over here and mining is over here. It's such a different set of rules, regulations, laws, mythology, the way we operate, why we do what we do, why we don't do some things. Most agency personnel that we deal with do not understand mining. I worked extensively with DEQ permit writers in 2004, all the way through 2005 for over 10 months. We did suction dredge demonstrations. We had probably close to a dozen meetings with DEQ personnel, either in Salem and actually right here in this building, over working over the permit that was finally issued in 2005. We had a consultation process, and it worked to some degree. A lot of things that would have been bad for mining didn't occur because of those meetings. In 2010, the permit was issued as an order instead of a rule, and there was no consultation. And we believe strongly that a different permit would have resulted had there been consultation. I'm not here to point fingers at anybody. We feel this is a good bill. It opens the door for consultation, and that's all we're really asking for, to be heard and to get a response back rather than just the regular public comment period and then a response to comments once the permit's been issued. By then, it's kind of too late, and our only option then is to go to court if we don't like it. And personally, we've been in court since 2005 against DEQ as one of the head fundraisers covering all this litigation at basically $1 a time. It's basically destroyed my life. There has to be a better way to do this, and we feel this is it. I would also remind the committee, just you probably already know this, that this bill did pass through the House unanimously, 60-0. At the time, DEQ was actually for the bill. I believe they're neutral at this point, but I'll let them speak for themselves. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. It seems like answered everybody's questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. And we have three people that have signed up, and then I think we will call up the Department of Environmental Quality because we have them here. So Jim Myron, Tom Wolf, and Peggy Lynch. I was going to say the three amigos, but I won't say that. Amigas. Amiga and amigos, yeah. Everyone's good first.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelter and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Myron, representing Water Watch of Oregon. We have submitted our testimony electronically and in written form. Let me just summarize briefly our opposition to this bill. We think it's bad public policy to have special pre-rulemaking or pre-order consultation with a select group of individuals or special interests. We're not against consultation. We think it's a way to resolve the issues, and we participate in consultations all the time, but we don't think it's appropriate for the agencies to consult only with the miners. We think there should be a broad spectrum of interested parties at that table, not just the user groups. So we prefer to have a wholly transparent rulemaking process. The waters of the state by statute belong to all the people of the state, and any rulemaking regarding Oregon's waters needs to be open, inclusive, and transparent. We also believe that 2841A puts an unnecessary burden on state agencies at a time when natural resource agency budgets are already strained, and the last thing for the legislature to do is to impose what we feel could be some fairly onerous tasks, such as notifying all parties that are likely to be affected by the rule or order. And the bill also directs agencies only to address the rights of the parties engaged in mining. That ignores the rights of the public and all the other user groups and interest groups that have a stake in the public resources at play here. So with that, I'll summarize and just simply say we don't support this bill, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Peggy?
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League follows rulemaking not only at natural resource agencies, but a large variety of state agencies as we follow elections, human services, public safety, almost all those areas where rules are considered. We have always and will continue to argue for an open and accessible process for all rulemaking. We believe that the current state law sufficiently protects the opportunities of miners and others to participate in rulemaking. This bill is not needed, and in fact sets one set of public above others. We ask that you reject this bill. In reviewing the proposed amendment provided on OLIS, we certainly believe the proposal goes well beyond any fair access to rulemaking. If you consider adopting 2841A, we certainly ask that you not adopt the amendments that were submitted under Senator Farioli's name on OLIS. I would make a couple of other comments. As I understand it, there is a $25 DEQ permit to do some of this mining activity and no cost at DSL. And yet, so enforcement costs aren't covered as they are, for instance, with fishing license and what happens with the Oregon State Police. And what are the consequences to missing notified parties? It says all parties. I have to tell you, in my land use, wearing my land use hat, there are lots of times homeowners associations or groups who change hands and whose leadership changes, and the knowing who to notice for a particular action is often very difficult. So it would seem to me that that would be a very onerous burden to place on any agency. But again, we follow rulemaking issues in this legislature all the time, and we believe very serious that this is a very serious issue, that all the public needs to be involved in rulemaking, and we do our best to make sure that rulemaking opportunities are available to as many people as possible. We welcome the broad range because it does mean a better rule in the end, but we ask that this bill is rejected. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom.
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited also opposes this bill 2841A and the Dash 1 amendments. We feel that currently there already exists within the state for our natural resource agencies an excellent rulemaking process that brings everybody that's affected by a rule change, by decisions made on natural resources. It brings all the stakeholder groups to the table. For example, a few years ago, I sat for 3 years on the Lower Columbia River Management Plan, which looked at how to manage salmon populations, restore salmon populations, salmonid populations in the Lower Columbia River below Bonneville, and including the lower Willamette, below Willamette Falls. And they didn't bring just fishermen to the table. They brought landowners, they brought timber people, they brought everybody who had might have had been impacted by any rules. And everybody got a chance to meet and to talk, and they brought in the best science to deal with this. So out of that product came a plan that probably not everybody was 100% supportive of, but it was a fair process that brought everybody together. This bill sets aside one group and says that they need to be talked with before the other people. It doesn't include him, but that's not fair. I certainly understand that agencies sometimes are so burdened that they're not able to notify everybody or talk to everybody that needs to be included in that. Maybe that's something that needs to be improved in the future with more funding for the agencies to do a better job of notifying. But 2841A and the dash one are not the answer. We believe that we should keep the current rules and the current process because I try to limit feels that that process is working very well. Thank you.
All right, any questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And we'll have the department. Let me just ask, is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Okay. So we'll have the Department of Environmental Quality come up and give us your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Karen Tarno with the Department of Environmental Quality. We did not prepare a written testimony on this amendment that we're speaking to. That I believe the draft amendment sitting in front of you is the same draft amendment that I'll be speaking to. However, I did submit some comments for the record to just more fully explain our understanding of the intent of some of the elements of this bill, and I can describe those in just a minute.
Before you get started, I do have a question, and I've asked my staff to go back and look at the legislative history, but I'm assuming you did that research. When I look at this, I say, why is there one group that's called out, outside of our current Administrative Procedures Act requirements that we already have? And so I don't know if you can maybe share the legislative history that was adopted before I think any of us were here.
Sure. Unfortunately, Madam Chair, I can't explain that fully. The language that exists is in Dogami's statutes, as I understand, and I believe I heard it was sometime around 2000 or so that was adopted. Do you know?
Well, 1999, no. Because this says the original language said any rule pertaining to recreational or small-scale mining adopted after June 28, 1999 shall be adopted in consultation with affected parties.
Yeah.
That's all it says.
Sorry, I don't have the answer to the history on that.
Okay. Well, my staff will go back and take a look at it and send it out to the committee.
Sure.
Okay. Go
sure.
Ahead.
DEQ is neutral on the bill, but we are supportive of the intent and are comfortable with the language of this draft one amendment concept sitting before you. We feel that the bill aligns with what are our objectives of public involvement in rulemaking and permit development, which would be to ensure that we have the best information to make good decisions and to ensure that the public and the regulated entity, to give them the opportunity to understand how we came to those decisions. We don't read this bill to be restrictive. And don't intend to, do our work that way. It does provide for specific meetings with the regulated community itself. However, that's not different from our current practice, whether it's in other general permits that we've adopted recently, pesticide permit for irrigators, stormwater permit for sand and gravel community. We, I could say almost always are engaging with the regulated community directly, as well as other interested stakeholders. A question came up before about the language in the bill as it's written about advisory committee. And that language was removed from the amendment that you're looking at right now simply because it was unnecessary language. I think the APA sets out the opportunity for the agencies may convene advisory committees, so there's nothing in this bill that requires or prohibits that from taking place. I think the couple of the some of the comments that we submitted, just a couple of points that I'll clarify in that, and this is our understanding of what this means, and I believe this is also the mining community's understanding as well, but they could speak for themselves. Our expectation is that this amendment, this change in statute, it does not establish any requirement or expectation that consensus is reached or that all disputes are resolved. What information does come forward in written form out of this process would be entered into the public record, but it would be given no greater or lesser consideration than other information submitted to the record. And the other point I would make is just that the definition of, you know, with agencies that engage, you know, when we're doing rulemaking or issuing orders that pertain to recreational small-scale mining, we understand this to mean, you know, for DEQ, our regulatory requirements on mining or permits and permit conditions, terms and conditions that that affect how mining can take place, but not to other kinds of rulemaking that we do conduct, which could include water quality standards that might also play into our permits for suction dredge mining. So that was just, I believe that's a shared understanding on that point. I think that's all I have to say and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for DEQ? Senator Hansel.
It's not a big one, but you're still using stationery that has Theodore Kulongoski as governor.
Oh, dear.
Good catch. Well, they're this saving money, so they can...
This is what happens when my administrative support isn't around to make the copies for me, and I pull out the wrong letterhead. I apologize for that.
We won't tell the governor. This governor, anyway. I actually did have a question about, and I realize that this is an existing statute. Mm-hmm. However, I guess I will ask, like, why, I mean, I would assume that you would consult with stakeholders on any rule, I mean, as part of the Administrative Procedures Act.
Mm-hmm.
So is there, is there a reason why that hasn't been happening or that, sure, that has been happening and there's not enough time? I mean,
yes,
certainly we have requirements under our Oregon Administrative Procedures Act. So do you want to comment on that?
Chair Dingfelder, as Mr. Pritchard pointed out, originally what they wanted to do was put, in addition to consulting on rules, it would be to extend that consultation
orders
to orders.
Right.
And that dates back to, I think, 2005, when we clarified in statute that for wastewater general permits that the agency can issue those by order as well as a rule. So I believe the intent here was to essentially put on par the requirement for the engagement, the consultation with the regulated community. That requirement, as far as I know, doesn't exist in statute for other kinds of entities like the sand and gravel industry when we're doing a sand and gravel general permit, but it is. But in rule, we do have established certain kinds of public involvement requirements for different kinds of permits, and we do in rule talk about the public involvement, public hearing process for our general permits that are issued by order. So we have some expectations in our agency that we already undertake. This formalizes it more for this particular community.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Ma'am, do you, in regulating the great morass of things you guys regulate, which is just everything in this state, do you...
We try.
...have other... do you have other interest groups that get, you know, not special treatment, but are you just discuss with them situations, or would small-scale miners be the only one that you would be on a one-on-one basis with them?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, it's our practice to discuss with the regulated entity, consult with them, really, on an informally consult with them whenever we're developing a permit. What we're talking about here is our general permit, so it affects a whole group of regulated persons, but also when we when we're developing an individual permit, such as for an industry or a municipal treatment plant, we also have in our regulations a requirement that before we go to public notice on a draft individual wastewater permit, we allow that regulated entity at least 2 weeks to review and provide us feedback on the permit before it goes to public notice. And the intent here is to, you know, have the best understanding of their practice and so that we can bring that information in as we're deciding how to establish the terms and conditions that are necessary to protect the resource.
Some concept that was brought forward was the fact that there was other stakeholders involved in water right-of-ways. So therefore, it would seem their concern is the fact that recreation miners are getting a break because they get to talk and nobody else gets in there. So let me ask you, you probably have some regulation of the chicken industry. Do you bring in the stakeholders who represent the wolf population, the coyote population, other game hens or anything like that? I mean, do you sit down with the chicken industry and discuss with them, or do you ask everybody in the entire state to come and chat on this, or do you have specific people that you just consult with to find out what is necessary in their industry?
Sure. Thank you for the follow-up, Senator Olson. We do make it a practice to consult with the interested and affected parties. An example would be we're going through the process right now of renewing our suction dredge permit. We've kicked off that public involvement process in earlier this spring in March, I believe, and we have over the next several months several meetings set up with miners and with the environmental interest and anybody else who would want to participate to, you know, get their input and their feedback on some of the concepts that we'll be considering for that process.
Follow up. How many other than dredge mining, which we're talking about now, how many other entities do you do this with? Like I said, chickens, do you do this when you regulate car washes and when you regulate gas stations? Do you bring in the entire state of Oregon to discuss a consultation, or is it, do you do it one-on-one with them as per what this bill, 2841, would request?
Senator Dingfelder.
Or Senator perhaps Olson. You don't know yeah. the answer to that. Maybe you don't.
I think it would vary in, you know, given the particular permit that we're working on. Some of them have much broader interests. Some of them are much more narrow interest. For instance, an individual wastewater permit, we're probably focused more of our communications and permit development with the regulated entity. Other groups, for general permits, sometimes there is an obvious group of affected parties or other public that are want to engage, and sometimes not so much. So it's certainly our intent to engage with the public that wants to participate in this effort with us. There's not as explicit as would be established with this bill. There's not as explicit directive onto as to how we go about engaging, reaching out to the public on that for other matters as there would be with the adoption of this amendment for the small-scale and recreational mining.
One follow-up.
Follow-up, and then Senator Bates has a question.
And it seems to me that there are other situations where you don't interact with the public because we just did a compost bill that would require you actually to have public testimony that wasn't available earlier. So you were reacting or really working with the compost industry to get, you know, their needs and your needs, but it wasn't that open door policy that I was just discussing. So I think composting would be an example of that. Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Oh, thank you. As a practical matter, what does this bill really do? I'm a little confused after listening to all this testimony.
Sure.
You know, you have a rulemaking process. You talk to a lot of people about those rules before you make the rules. And as near as I can tell, all this calls for is that prior to rulemaking or rulemaking hearings, you have a consultation with or discussion with miners first before you talk to anybody else, and then you go on to a public policy or public rulemaking and a public testimony, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really understand what the difference here is of any real significance. So maybe you can just, in real simple terms, tell me what that is.
Sure. Chairman Dingfelder, Senator Bates, I could, in very specific terms, what we're anticipating this would mean for our current process, our current permit renewal process. We already have established, as I said, a number of meetings with the mining community, with the environmental community, and other public that wants to get involved over the summer and into the fall, which we'll be taking to them and hearing from them on specific issues that we want to consider as we're renewing our permit and updating it. as we look at what this amendment would do, it would add to it additional engagement with the mining community, with the regulated community, prior to going to public notice. So we have these work sessions with a variety of stakeholder groups earlier on, getting their input, and then we get to the work of drafting the actual permit. So we put a lot more of the concepts together and construct the actual language. And so once we're getting closer to having that draft permit scoped out, that's when we would engage in this consultation process with the mining community. And we will get their additional feedback on that crafted language to see if that educates us in any way about better ways to language some of the requirements, different ways to achieve the same outcome through different means that has more practicality for their practices, that kind of thing.
Follow up real quickly. Would those meetings be open to the public? Would they be under the public meetings laws? Would everyone want to go to it and discuss it with you? Could they be there also?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, as I understand this bill, these meetings would not be open public meetings.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we will ask legal counsel about that, since that would be different from the Administrative Procedures Act, my understanding. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else would like to testify on this bill we haven't heard from already? Okay. With that, we will go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2841A. We have a series of work sessions that we're going to start. So we are currently in work session on House Bill 2801A. Do we have a fiscal yet for that?
No, Madam Chair, we do not have a fiscal yet.
Okay, so we will do the other work sessions over and then check back in to see if that miraculously appears before we adjourn this hearing or this meeting today. So we will go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2025. There's no way. So just House Bill 2025.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2025A. Please do
that. Is there an A?
Typo on my sheet report.
No, there's no A here. It's
okay.
Just 2025.
So, Madam Chair, House Bill 2025, you have the dash, I think it's a typo on that. It's the A8 amendment that you have in front of you. It maintains that a person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly violates a provision of a livestock at large statute is guilty of Class A misdemeanor. So that maintains a current standard. And then it stipulates that a person that violates provision of livestock at large statute but does not intentionally act, but does not do it intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly would commit a Class B violation, and that a person that does not intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and does not have a prior conviction for violating the same statute would create a Class D violation and establishes a presumptive fine for violation is $60. The base part of the bill makes a person liable to a landowner for resulting economic damage if the person owns or possesses a bison running at large.
Madam Chair, for clarity,
on
the amendment, it says it does call it a engrossed bill.
Right.
It is an A engrossed.
So that is a typo. So it should be House Bill 2025A, because this on OLIS it's listed as the A engrossed House bill. Uh-huh. All right. It's, I think, your first one, Beth. We'll let you go on that one. So it should be 2025A. All right. So we are in work session. I will take a motion.
Sorry. Error number two for the day.
No.
Probably actually seven.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the Dash 8 amendments dated 5/16/2013.
The Senator also moves to adopt the Dash A8 amendments dated 5/16/2013. Is there any discussion? And Beth, you talked to the proponents of the bill, and they support this amendment, correct?
And the Judicial Department is here. They helped us draft the amendment. They work with Senator Boquist on that, so that I think everyone is aligned and okay with the Dash 8 amendment.
Okay, so is there any discussion? Any objections to adopting this amendment? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Dingfelder, I move House Bill 2025A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
The Senator also moves House Bill 2025A as amended with the Dash A8s to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder.
Aye. That House Bill 2025A passes as amended to the floor. Any, I guess, volunteers for this bill?
Unless Senator Boqvist would like
to. Okay, why don't we ask Senator Boqvist, and we'll have Senator Olson as a backup if needed. Okay, great. Thank you. We'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2025A, open up a work session on House Bill 2820B. Beth, you want to remind us about this bill that we just heard?
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2820B, there's a dash 13 or dash B11 amendment in front of you. It replaces the measure and adds the definition of solar thermal power plants energy facility list requiring FSEC approval. It defines solar photovoltaic power generation facility requiring FSEC approval as one using no more than 100 acres of high-value farmland, 100 acres located on predominantly cultivated land or land that is predominantly composed of Class 1 to Class 4 soils, or 320 acres land located on any other land, exempt facility established on site of the decommissioned United States Air Force facility.
Okay, so we just heard this the other day, and this is the amendment that the Department of Energy was talking about. If we have any questions, they're here. Do you have a question, Senator?
Yes.
Have the department come up? Okay. Todd, can you come up, please? So we are in a work session. Well, why don't we go ahead and answer these questions, and then we can see if we have a motion here. Thanks, Todd. Senator, did you have a specific question about
this? Yes, my question is, what has been the response to this additional amendment by local planning commissions on the county level?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Siting Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Energy. Senator Hansel, the response to your question, we did have a meeting on Friday. Most of the stakeholders, not all the stakeholders, but many of the stakeholders who are part of the working group were there, including some of the county representatives who did express a concern about the dash B11 amendments. And at the conclusion of that meeting, I would characterize their response as cautiously supportive. There are still some concerns about maybe how this thing is going to work, but there was nobody who was opposing the bill in the dash B11 form at that point. I do have a handout. It kind of goes through some of what the proposed dash B11 amendments do. I can go over that, or I can just leave it with you, whatever your preference is.
I think we can read it, unless, Senator, do you want him to walk through that? Or, and we also have AOC here. Why don't we have AOC come up so we can hear directly from them?
That'd be helpful.
Right. No, I think it's fine, unless you have any questions down on this end. Hi there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell from the Association of Counties. Yes, we indeed participated in the meeting on Friday with most of the stakeholders, and we went through the bill, discuss concerns and the future of how we might operate. And I would say that we are in 90% in support of the way we are moving ahead. You certainly took care of the issue of removing the definition of arable lands so that we end up with one definition, not two, upon which we have to administer the land use laws at the local level. And you know, today is not the end of the world. So we will start working on this process. If there are any issues that come up later on that need to be clarified, we can certainly go to FSEC. We can come to the legislature and resolve those. So I think I would say that we are in support of this amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Does that answer your question?
Yep.
Senator? Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And we are in a work session, so I will take a motion.
Chair Dingfelter, I move to adopt the dash B11 amendments dated 5/16/2013.
Okay, Senator Olson moves the dash B11 amendments dated 5/16/2013. Is there any discussion? I just want to thank the department for working on this and everyone else who's been working several years on this and working closely with the counties. So I appreciate that. Is there any objection to the amendment? Okay, seeing none. B11 The amendments are adopted.
Chair Dingfelter, I move House Bill 2820B as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves House Bill 2820B as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Aye. That the motion carries and or passes. Is there any volunteers for this? Senator Hansel, are you interested?
I would do it.
Okay, great. So with that, we have Senator Hansel's carrier, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2820B. Okay, we'll open up a work session on House Bill 3096A.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3096A allows a water improvement district to take ownership and operate existing sanitary sewer facility and allows a water district to file notice of lien and collect delinquent charges in a manner consistent with the collection of incurred charges by an irrigation district. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, and we have no amendment for that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Okay, so I'll take a motion on the bill.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3096A be reported out of committee with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves House Bill 3096A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
One for Central Oregon, isn't it?
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and Senator Knope had requested to carry this bill. So we will anoint him as the carrier, and I can be the backup if for any reason there's an issue there. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3096A. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 3364A. Reminder there.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3364A directs the Dean of College of Agricultural Science of the Oregon State University to appoint a faculty member to act as the State Integrated Pest Management Coordinator. It establishes an Integrated Pest Management Coordinating Committee and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. We are in work session, so I'll take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3364A be reported out of committee with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 3364A be reported out of committee with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and I will carry that bill to the floor. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3364A. So, Beth, we have any updates on House Bill 2801A?
I did hear back, and they are in the review process, but I think we're going to have to carry it over for tonight to the agenda on Wednesday.
Okay, so we will have to carry over the work session on House Bill 2801A because the fiscal analysis is not complete, and we'll have that back up first thing on Wednesday then. So with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2801A. Anything else for the good of the order?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. That we are adjourned. Thank you. Okay.